Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Let's be honest, local politics usually isn't razzle-dazzle. That's what Claire Dunphy experienced on a recent episode of ABC's Modern Family when she tried to get a stop sign for a dangerous neighborhood intersection.
I'm here for the traffic committee meeting.
The meeting's been adjourned.
Someone sent me to the wrong room, and you guys don't meet again for months, and this is pretty much a matter of life and death, so...
Yes, fine. Do you have your 50 signatures?
Almost. I have 34, but...
Mom!
Oh, my God, what are you doing here, girls?
We went door to door, and we got you 20 more signatures.
54 signatures. So, what do you say? Let's start saving lives one intersection at a time.
Okay, thank you very much. We will take these under advisement. Just leave them here, and thank you.
Wait a minute! I know what that means.
Oh, here we go.
That's Washington speak for get lost.
Well, local government can seem like a lot of ordinances and meetings and committees, but it affects our lives in real ways, and it's also an area of civic life we have real power to affect. Today's example, city-county consolidation. You, the voters, will be asked to decide whether or not Evansville City and Vandenberg County government should merge. If you don't know what to think, stick around. We're exploring the issue with Consolidation Committee Chair Becky Kasha. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
And Courier Press Metro reporter Richard Goody. Hi, Richard.
Hi, how are you today?
And Becky Kasha, I want to start with you. Before the eyes glaze over and all the radios turn off, why should I care about consolidation? Why do you care about consolidation?
Well, I was concerned about government reform long ago when I was teaching merit badges to Boy Scouts, and I was teaching them about the various levels of government, and I ended up on it with a chalkboard with all these circles and X's and O's all over, and I thought, gosh, if anybody was going to design government, they would never have designed it the way we have it now. All the overlap and the repetition. And so when I heard about the opportunity to get involved in consolidation, I thought this was a chance to make our government something that made more sense, the government structure make more sense.
Because it gets increasingly complex. You can say, okay, federal government, but then you get down to
exactly.
Smaller and smaller levels, and it gets, there's more and more minutia. And
absolutely. I mean, it's certainly an issue of confusion and jurisdictional overlap. But there's also, to my way of thinking, that as I got more educated about it, the Kernan Shepherd report that came out several years ago was talking about how inefficient our government is in Indiana on various levels. And I'm convinced that government reform in some form or fashion is coming. So we in Vandenberg County and Evansville could sit back and wait and get something imposed upon us, or we could take the initiative and come up with a plan that was right for our community. And I thought that made more sense.
And you've been a voice in favor of this. Is that one of the reasons that you support the idea?
Yes, absolutely.
Are there other reasons?
Oh, sure. I think that with the shrinking tax base and the tax caps, causing a great deal of that, that we are going to have to explore every possible avenue for making government more efficient on one hand, and also making our government as nimble and capable of economic development. And I feel that a combined government will give us an opportunity for a unified vision for moving forward on economic development.
So that's sort of the big picture look at it, and a long-range sort of vision way of understanding what consolidation could accomplish. But Richard Goody, there are a lot of people who are looking at it more from a financial angle, and that casts it in a different light, doesn't it?
Yeah, it definitely did. Part of the when local officials were debating the plan and making modifications to the plan that your committee put forward at the beginning of this year, there were a couple of camps. There were people that were for it because of the long range vision that you were talking about. Also, people who from the commissioners and the council who just thought it was their responsibility to move the plan forward to the voters. And then they would themselves kind of look back at the plan and look at some of the financial savings. Now, when you talk about financial savings, that's when it becomes into a much shorter time period issue. The two boards never really hammered down the specifics on how somebody's property tax rates would be affected if they currently lived outside the city or if they were currently inside the city limits. And that was a big issue for some people, but others pointed out that you can set the budget however you want, using whatever level. I mean, if this is passed, the Common Council will be able to set the budget where it wants. And so if you want them to save 3%, then you just tell them that you saved 3%. But, I mean, kind of with everything, I mean, with all the uproar about taxes, that became an issue for some people. They wanted more specifics, even though it's been pointed out that that's hard to tell from year to year.
With our government as it is, it's hard to tell. Yeah.
Regardless, I mean, this plan wouldn't even take effect if approved until 2015. So doing that now in 2011 is not impossible, but it's also a harder task than saying, okay, this is exactly what it's going to save.
You know, and I would point out on that front that with the tax caps in place, no one who's an individual homeowner's taxes can be greater than 1% of their assessed value. And so that was a big argument that scared people away, but that certainly has diminished the threat considerably. I, you know, it's all public record, and you can go on and check and see where you're at. And I know that, you know, lots of people are very close to the 1% cap, if not already there. And I think people need to bear that in mind before they decide how frightening or whatever the potential for tax increases become.
Now, when you were considering how to propose consolidation, you were the chair of the committee. It was a 12-person committee.
Correct.
What role did financial considerations play?
We tried to look more at the bigger picture. We had a public an accounting firm that was conversant in government and public accounting put together a variety of scenarios for us to consider. For example, if we took the cost of law enforcement and spread it out over the county equally, as opposed to having the current situation where the county paid for sheriff and the city paid for sheriff and county, mm-hmm. you know, that's one scenario. And in that situation, the people in the county ended up picking up a little bit larger part of that cost. But that's certainly one of just many, many variables that could have been considered when you put together a budget. So we did look at the financial aspect of it, but I tried to keep us looking at the bigger picture of simply putting together the government, the skeleton structure of the government, not making decisions about how many garages we would have and how many people would be in each garage. That's something that the government elected officials and the department heads need to make decisions about, and typically in merged governments, it's been done after some sort of an efficiency study. That's not a decision that a volunteer board should have been involved in.
Right. So you figure that out after consolidation is enacted and people are empowered
Precisely.
To make those decisions.
Right.
Now, Richard, Becky brought it up, public safety. I know that was just a really contentious issue, and sort of a weird decision was made on that. I'm not casting aspersions your way, Becky, but it was an odd way of handling it, one could say.
Yeah, it definitely was. And they had a series of six workshops before they started putting together or making a lot of the modifications. And as soon as I walked into the workshop about law enforcement, it was immediately clear that it wasn't going to be an immediate merger. And that was because a lot of people, I heard words as killer. I mean, that it would automatically kill the plan. And now people, some people against the that spoke up against the plan, just have made the point, well, that should be included in a merged government. And so, but it was kind of strange because it was like the local officials looked at their role as getting a plan forward that, if passed, even people who voted against the referendum would still be okay with or still could live with. And so something that, and that's just kind of an odd feeling on whether or not as a merger proponent if you think that that's a good idea or a bad idea. But
the fear was it would become that single issue. We'll talk about that more in just a minute here. City-county consolidation is trending now on WNIN. We're talking with Becky Casha and Richard Goody. More after a break.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Support for the program today comes from Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life for more than 60 years. Information online at evansvilledayschool.org. And through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimtonoggle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Still ahead, Tech Talk compares Steve Jobs to a beetle, not the insect, the band, and how a local company fits into the global economy. But right now we're exploring city-county government consolidation with Becky Casha from the Consolidation Committee and Richard Goody from the Courier and Press. And Richard, we left off talking about how the fear was that public safety could turn into a deal breaker for a consolidation referendum, that it would turn into that single issue that would turn voters off and people wouldn't look beyond that to explore the plan further.
Mm-hmm. And that was one thing that, as you watched, kind of struck you as odd, that they were taking out things from a merger plan that would merge departments together. And one thing that I haven't asked you yet, Becky, would be, I mean, as somebody who put forward not only the initial plan but as also a merger supporter, I mean, kind of what was the feelings going through your head when that was taking place? I mean, do you feel like it's still a strong plan individually instead of just, I mean, being supportive of the issue?
Well, I think it does not affect the highest level goal that I had, which was to have a unified vision within government. The top level of government, it will be unified. And that was, of course, a disappointment that they took out the law enforcement, the merger of the two law enforcement agencies. But I wouldn't withdraw my support from the merger because of it. But I mean, I appreciated why they did it. I think there was a small but very vocal group of people that were against merging the two, and obviously the members of the FOP. And my understanding, it was
the Fraternal Order of Police.
Yes, by no means all of the police or sheriff were against the plan to merge them. A lot of them felt that made a lot of sense, both the police and the sheriff. Deputies, but it was ultimately taken out of the plan, as you said, I think because they were concerned that it would kill the vote. But I think that it may have the opposite effect, because that was one thing that was very, very appealing to people in the county, was to have it merged under the sheriff. And we lost another level of bureaucracy, because the sheriff is a constitutional office. We can't get rid of it. So that made the most sense. And also, if you wanted to cast this in terms strictly of cost containment, that's the biggest item in the issue, biggest item in the budget is law enforcement, and we've left that essentially untouched.
So this issue has now been pushed off for ultimate consideration by the transitional council, which would be formed if the referendum passes next year. Let's talk a little bit about what would change. And there's again, two ways of looking at this. You can look at it as a county resident. You can look at it as a city resident. But Richard, what are some of the changes that people would experience if they vote yes for merging city and county government?
Well, I think the biggest thing for a normal citizen, at least from my point of view, would be that you'd only have one council. Basically, the county council and the city council would be merged into one body. It would be a 15-member body. It'd be, I believe it's 12 districts, and then three at-large members. They wanted to keep the at-large members because they said that it was a mini mayor, and they wanted to be able to be able to serve the whole community in case there was something that council member couldn't take care of at the time. And then there also wouldn't be the county commissioners. They serve as the executive branch of current county government, and they would just basically, a mayor would be in charge of the whole unified government.
And so you'd have this one executive, whether you call it a mayor or whatever the name is. This touches a bit on something you brought up at the beginning of the interview, Becky Kasha, and that is that there would be one vision relating to economic development. Can you talk a little bit about what one executive would do?
Under the plan, the executive branch would be the mayor, and the legislative branch and fiscal branch would be the common council. They would pass the budget as suggested by the mayor. And I think Vandenberg County and Evansville have experienced some situations where the city and the county were not on the same page as to how to move forward. And there were a couple instances where the city and the county were competing for the same businesses, whether they would locate in the city or the county. And that's unfortunate. And now with just one mayor who has the common vision for all citizens, regardless of where they live, I think that streamlines the process and certainly makes it easier for people who are looking to come to the area, that you don't have to navigate the whole process on the city level, and then you don't have to navigate the whole process again on the county level.
But county residents often, at least some, have a different view of this, and I've heard the term forced annexation. What are some of the concerns that county members bring, or county, not members, but residents bring to the idea of consolidation?
Well, one of the problems I think I hear a lot is that, and this sort of surprised me, I was not aware of it, a lot of the county residents don't feel like they want to be a part of what they consider the urban lifestyle, and they see this as them having to become part of the urban lifestyle, and I don't see that as happening by any stretch. And they won't be paying for services they don't receive, unless and until they receive them, and all the debt that may have been incurred by the city prior to the merger will be only taxed city residents that were residents who were in the city before the merger, and same with the county. So we're not spreading, if you will, old debt around. So there's a provision in the plan that the zoning that's in effect now will stay in effect after the merger, so it won't affect farming or agricultural operations. So there really isn't any forced change of lifestyle on anyone, and there isn't any tax burden that's forced on people because of the merger. So I think it's a feeling as opposed to reality.
But Richard, there's a change in representation that takes place.
Well, just to piggyback onto what Becky said, the mayor could conceivably be from outside current city limits.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's something that a lot of people overlooked or chose not to recognize, and maybe the likelihood of that is not as high, and maybe they're right, but that's, I mean, that person doesn't have to automatically come from within city limits.
Ironically, now county government, there's only one person that represents anyone outside of the city who actually lives outside of the city. I found that very amusing.
And that's under the current system.
Yes, exactly.
So maybe the fears about the possibility of a new system, you're saying, are not fully grounded in reality.
I think they were afraid that they would be, their representatives would be people who didn't understand their lifestyle because they didn't live in the rural part of the county, but that's the way it is now.
Go ahead,
Richard.
I was going to say, as she pointed out, there's two different taxing districts. And so it's not, if the new government takes effect in 2015, not everybody is going to be taxed at the same level and not everybody is going to receive the same services. So I mean, if you live in the northernmost part of the county, I don't think a lot of your government change or your government services are going to change, and you're still going to pay close to the same level as what you were paying before. It will change it slightly, and that's still specifically undetermined on how that will change, but it's not going to be the drastic change like Becky referenced. It's not okay, you're automatically going to be in the middle of some urban area. You're still going to be there, and you're still getting the same services that you got before. And unless you unless they decide to expand the urban services district, which doesn't seem as likely as some people think, then you're not going to pay that extra money for those services.
Becky, we have about 10 seconds. I'll give you the last word. What changes if we vote for this?
Well, I said I think that we've become a community that's put itself on the map in terms of looking toward the future. And I think that will be very appealing to employers as they look at locating in Evansville. And I think that's a huge step forward for us.
Becky Kasha chaired the Consolidation Committee, and Richard Goody's article on consolidation is in this Sunday's Evansville Courier and Press. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Still ahead on the trend, how Cargus Furniture balances local roots and global economics. And it's time now for our weekly segment we call Tech Talk, where our associate producer and engineer Tony Voss brings us the latest news and tips from the technology world. This week, Tony, we're remembering former Apple CEO Steve Jobs.
Yeah, Micah, and we wanted to acknowledge Steve Jobs' passing last week, but by now everyone's talked about him. So our technology expert Justin Williams and I kicked around some ideas, and one of them seemed especially relevant. So I asked Justin the question of where Jobs fits, not in the tech world, but in the world of pop culture.
I really wasn't sure of an answer to this question when he resigned as CEO, and that was a month ago, and we talked about his lasting legacy on technology. But when the news broke last week that he had actually passed away, the reaction I saw both from myself and from people all over the internet was way more than I thought. For me personally, like even as somebody who loves to use Apple products, I didn't think that it would bother me that this guy that I've never met in my life and all I've ever done is given him money for his products, I didn't think it would impact me that much. But I've kind of spent that entire night just like reading stories people posted on the internet or looking at old videos, and it really kind of bothered me. And I saw that it bothered a lot of other people, both people interested in technology like myself, and like even my mother was like shaken by it, and she barely uses a computer. And it got me thinking that this went on for several days, actually, and it's probably still going on now, is that he had such an impact on not just technology, but also our culture, because these devices are part of our culture. And it's kind of like his passing so soon, before he was able to complete his life's work, it kind of reminds me of when John Lennon went away. And Steve Jobs wasn't the guy who was like sitting there and writing code and drawing gradients in Adobe Photoshop to design these products, but he was the one who had his hands on everything and created them and knew what to do to make them perfect. And he's basically changed how we use technology and how it interacts and changes with our lives. And it's going to have a lasting legacy, much like the Beatles music did.
And I think this John Lennon comparison is particularly apt when you consider what both Steve Jobs and John Lennon meant, not only to culture, but to youth culture. The music of John Lennon spoke very much in the 60s and the 70s to what younger people were concerned about in the world. The work of Steve Jobs has really defined what young people are interested in and are going into as professions now.
Right. I wasn't around when John Lennon passed away. I wasn't around when Beatles music was popular. My general vibe is that all of this with the Beatles and Lennon is that they were very counterculture. And that is certainly how I would describe the stuff that Apple has made forever. They've kind of always bucked the status quo. When everyone's trying to make the cheapest computers, Apple is instead focusing on building something that's beautiful and might cost a little bit more, but it's going to delight their users more than something that's just a couple hundred bucks cheaper. Or when everyone said that it would be crazy to go into the music market because no one wants to buy digital music players, Apple came out with the iPod and sold billions of the things. Or the same with the iPhone and even the iPad. And these are just all things that are definitely shaping how we're going to be using technology now. And I think, especially in the case of the iPhone, I think 10 years from now, when we're using the iPhone 10 or whatever awesome new phone is out there, be it from Apple, Google, or somebody completely new, it's going to remind us of that original iPhone that came out in 2007, because that was such a transition from what smartphones and just general feature phones were before that.
And I guess the natural outgrowth question here, after John Lennon died, certainly it was who would fill that role, who would take that place as a sort of leader in pop culture and in the counterculture. If you look at the type of people that are in the technology world now, Steve Jobs is very different from, say, a Bill Gates.
When Bill Gates passes on, I don't think you're going to see people standing in front of Microsoft stores or PC shops and writing notes on Post-its or on Microsoft stickers like they did at the Apple stores. If you go to any Apple store around the world right now, there are just little Post-it notes of people writing notes to Steve. Or like I went to the Indianapolis one and there was just a string of different Apple stickers that weren't on the back of car windows. They were instead on there and they had little notes just to thanking Steve, or there's flowers in front of them. I think you might see that at like Microsoft's campus, but I don't think that Bill Gates has had that big of an impact on pop culture as Steve Jobs has in the past decade.
Maybe this is getting a little too nerdy, but the other side of that, probably a little too counterculture, would be a figure like Steve Wozniak.
Bill Gates can't fill that role because Bill Gates isn't a showman. Bill Gates is a computer scientist, and he's a fantastic one. Steve Jobs and Bill Gates are what shaped personal computing today. Steve Wozniak hasn't really been around since the late 80s. He's the like lone Apple founder that's left, but he's not involved in the company anymore. I don't think we're going to see somebody from the technology industry going forward that has the showmanship and style of Steve Jobs. I think that's kind of a once in a generation sort of thing.
Justin, where do we go from here? What can we learn from how the world recovered from John Lennon's passing to help us move past passing on of Steve Jobs?
I was talking to one of my friends the other day, and he said he called his dad and asked him, when John Lennon died, how did people get over it? Because that obviously affected a lot of people. And he said, we got over it by listening to Beatles songs and listening to John Lennon records. And I think that's the same thing that's going to happen with the Steve Jobs passing away, is that people are going to continue using these devices. Most people found out about the news on an Apple device. They found out using a Mac, or they found out on their iPhone. I found out from the ESPN app on my iPhone sending me a push notification. I couldn't even imagine something like that happening 10 years ago. So I think we're going to keep using these products that he's had his hands on, both crafting the ones that are out now and then the ones that are going forward that are built with his imagination and for his legacy.
And to hear past Tech Talk segments, head over to WNIN.org, where you can podcast past episodes of The Trend. And if you have any questions or suggestions for future Tech Talk conversations, we'd love to hear them. Send them to us on Facebook, Twitter, or through email. Links are all at WNIN.org. Thank you, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schwein. For more than a century, Cargus Furniture has been creating custom-made, handcrafted furniture in its family-owned Evansville factory. Even today, the operation seems a bit old-fashioned. No assembly line, no outsourcing, no stockholders, the same designs as decades ago. So how does a company like this make it in the global marketplace? Fifth-generation Cargus family member Gretchen Keith is here to explain. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
And so is Courier and Press business reporter Susan Orr. Welcome.
Hello.
Now, Gretchen Keith, a dining room table costs about $15,000. Who buys these?
We have, of course, a select clientele that has the income that allows them to not care how much they spend on whatever they want. And so, of course, with that clientele, we end up with famous celebrities. And
we mentioned Billy Idol earlier.
Exactly. We've had Billy Idol. We've had different dignitaries from all over the world. We've had, I believe, Michael Jackson, a lot of sports enthusiasts or sports players, and, you know, Saudi Arabians.
The Saudi Minister of Education.
Yes,
is that, right?
That was a recent order that we had early this year. We had come in, and he evidently found out about Cargus because his friend, who is a Jordanian, had ordered Cargus years ago, and he saw our furniture in his home and decided that's what he needed, that's what he wanted. And our furniture prices sound crazy, and it's when you look at the lower price furniture, it is quite expensive,
right, because
compared
you can go
to that.
Buy a dining room, yes, table for a few, yes, hundred bucks if you want to somewhere.
You can.
So what's the difference?
One of the things is, you know, you see antiques all over Europe, and really that's what we're making. We're making the new antiques of the future. It is not a disposable product. It will be around for hundreds of years. Yeah, you'll have to have some finish work done on it along the way, especially if my kids are involved. But it is something that you hold on to. It's an heirloom. It's a treasure. And it's very expensive to make. It's not an assembly line, as you say. Many furniture companies have their materials as the highest cost in the product. Ours is the labor. Every single thing is done by hand. And we have right around 50 employees right now. And everybody has their hands on that furniture. And so hours of labor it takes to manufacture that one unique custom piece of furniture for that person.
When you gave me a tour of the factory last Tuesday, and I naively came over with my digital recorder and my microphone, and there was no sound. I mean, you know, a fan maybe, or a blower on a sander or something like that. But other than that, it didn't sound like what I thought a factory would sound like. And I walked away with the impression that this was more like a collection of artist studios with people doing incredibly detailed, fine, skilled work.
Exactly. My grandmother, I believe, took a friend of hers through the factory years ago, and she said, "Oh, are they all on break?" And my grandmother said, "No, they're working." It is like a bunch of little artists with their own little cabinet. It's like a cabinet shop, like a individual cabinet shop. Everybody has their own tools. They get that piece of furniture. They do whatever wonderful thing they do to it. And if it takes them 3 hours to do it, or if it takes them 10 hours to do it, to get it just right, they know it's not leaving them until it's just right. And it's not anything that can be rushed through. And as I said, everybody touches that piece of furniture, whether it takes them an hour or some of the jobs take 15 hours. And when it's done, it's a tangible, beautiful product that they're proud of. And we all know every piece that goes through, because we don't do that many pieces.
About 10 a year.
Right? Which seems that way. Wow. But we run approximately, I believe we have about, I can't even remember anymore what the average piece number is a year. But I'd say probably about 300 pieces a year.
So
on average,
yeah.
I believe.
So they take a long time.
Yeah, it
to
takes
make,
a long yeah. time. It's about 4 months from the date that the customer sends us their order. And so they wait, and we aren't in a hurry. We aren't in a hurry. And it gets to them just exactly the way they ordered it. And it's theirs. Nobody else has one exactly like it.
Here's something else I saw on the way into the factory. Cargus Furniture is not accepting applications.
No, we are not. Unfortunately, we are not.
And you said you have about 50 employees now, but you had more than double that 10 years ago, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes. I started with the company, as I tell Mom, with a paycheck. I've been there for a long time, but they actually hired me about 16 years ago. And we were, I believe, about 135 people then. And
so what's happened?
You know, 9/11 was huge for us. We have a lot of international business, and the furniture industry has a market in High Point, North Carolina, like a convention that's twice a year. And after 9/11, a lot of the international travel was gone, and we saw things dropping off then, because our furniture is big, it's ornate, it's expensive, and it has always been a good product for the Middle East client. When they weren't traveling here as often because of 9/11, our business dropped considerably.
I want to bring Susan Orr into the conversation here. What are some of the pressures, Susan, that you're seeing companies like Cargus and other companies in the area facing when it comes to the economy? Was 9/11 kind of a, can you draw a starting point there?
It's hard to say. I think cost is a big part of it. I did some big stories last year when Whirlpool closed, mm-hmm. and looking at the reasons that companies do or do not move things overseas. And the wage gap is one thing that is hard to overcome. And in researching that story, I learned that the gap between U.S. and overseas wages has exponentially increased over the last couple decades. And so if it's strictly a cost thing and nothing else, wages are a big factor for sure.
And Gretchen, you said that wages make up the bulk of your expenses.
Absolutely.
Why
Absolutely.
Do you keep workers here?
Where else would they do this? You know, my great-great-grandfather started it, and it was a huge furniture area then. And the people make Cargus furniture. If it was made offshore in one of the many growing countries for industrial, it would not be Cargus. It wouldn't. I don't think it could be made on an assembly line and still be the way it is. And our people have, I believe the average seniority is 20, 25 years. They know what they're doing. They love this product, and they put a lot of heart and soul in it. And I don't think it would be what it is if it was outsourced.
Cargus Furniture and the Global Economy is trending right now. Talking with Gretchen Keith from Cargus and Susan Orr from the Courier and Press. More after a break. This is The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Join us for your chance to make a difference with a contribution in support of WNIN-FM during our fall fun drive. WNIN-FM is listener-supported public media, and this is the time of year when you have the opportunity to really make a difference with a donation to WNIN. Make a donation online at WNIN.org or during our fall fun drive, and make a difference to WNIN-FM.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Still ahead, our weekly feature, The Arts Notebook Goes to the Theater. Right now, we're talking with Gretchen Keith from Cargus Furniture and Susan Orr from the Courier and Press. And Susan, we just heard why Cargus doesn't outsource. What is the trend in terms of outsourcing with manufacturing companies here in the Evansville area? I mean, we saw Whirlpool, of course, but is that the norm?
I don't know if you can actually... It seems so... different between different companies, because I know with Whirlpool being an example, even though they moved the production that was in Evansville to Mexico, they also made a decision to refurbish a cooking facility in Tennessee rather than offshore in that. So even within the same company, they can make different business decisions. I have heard some things in the last year or so that things are maybe starting to either come back to the U.S. or not leave at as much of a pace. And I think there are some good things, like Gretchen had said, there's reasons to keep things in the U.S. You know, if it was only price, everybody would go overseas, but obviously there's other considerations too.
I know in the case of, say, a company like Toyota in Princeton, shipping cars just costs a fortune. I mean, it costs enough to ship a dining room table. You imagine shipping a car, that becomes
right.
a big, cuts a big chunk out of the profit.
Right, that's right. And you get transportation costs and logistics. And speaking of 9/11, like we were, a source once brought up to me, even if you make anything that involves chemicals, trying to get those in and out of the U.S. can be much more of a hassle now. So depending on what you make, there may be good reasons to do it all domestically.
What are some of the other pressures that you've had financially, Gretchen? I mean, I imagine it starts with 9/11 and international travel and so forth, but then we have the housing bust and
right.
the recession and this anemic recovery and fears of double dips. How has all of that affected you?
It's devastating, and you see it in all industries, but furniture industry has been especially nailed. I was talking to Susan earlier, and North Carolina with the textile and furniture plants have, you know, huge exodus out of the country. And it, of course, affected us. In the past, when the U.S. was suffering financially, international business would pick up. And this is a pretty much a global problem. Everybody has been affected. And you pair that with a rickety old inefficient building that leaks air and is cold in the winter and hot in the summer. And you asked on the tour about Finnish problems. We have horrible summers in Indiana, and you know, trying to get finished to dry, well, okay, you know, takes a couple of extra weeks to get this finished to dry. And so it's all kinds of juggling problems. And a lot of our dealers have gone out of business. The retail stores, mom and pop stores have, you know, they could not make it. So we've lost those customers to then represent our furniture, as well as so many people not having credit. They can't, you know, we can't ship them their furniture because they don't have any money to pay for the furniture. So it's everything is like a perfect storm. It's
where have you been able to find efficiencies? Obviously, your labor force has declined pretty significantly.
And we have wonderful people who wear many hats right now. And they pick up and figure out, okay, you know, this used to take this long to do this. I think if I, you know, do it this way, it might work a little bit better. This glue seems to work better. And it's the people that know us staying there allows them to have a job, and they work like it's their livelihood, and they figure out a way to make it as efficient as can. We say if we get business, we are going to be able to shoot furniture through there so great because we have become so lean and so efficient as much as we can.
Well, Susan Orr, what are some of the efficiencies you've seen visiting other companies? You know, those little things that might cost a few bucks but actually add up to real money.
Right. One that comes right to mind is HMC in Princeton, and they make large precision gears that go in all kinds of equipment, mining equipment and that sort of thing. And that company is decades old, and I know when I talked to them last year, they said with pride that they had never, ever laid off somebody. But they were talking about how hard that had been to accomplish. And in the recent downturn, they said it got to a point where they were penny-pinching to a level that they cut back on the number of work gloves that their floor employees could use, because usually they would go through X number of pairs in a week because it was just such rough work. And they said, hey, guys, you know, we're going to have to cut you back because we're looking at every possible way. And that just made me realize when you're down to the work glove level, you're really looking to squeeze everything that you can.
Gretchen, you're nodding your head.
Oh, absolutely. We have been on reduced hours for a couple of years, and it's everything, safety glasses, things that we used to take for granted. And, you know, we close off part of the factory in the wintertime so that, you know, everybody can kind of work together to be a little bit warmer and, you know, not heat certain areas. And we've told them, you know, the furniture is the most important, unfortunately, and we have to keep it at the correct temperature, but otherwise, you know, wear a jacket or whatever. And they do. It just, you know, it's what you have to do if you want to stay. You know, how far are you willing to go? And unfortunately, we have had to lay people off, and through no fault of their own, but just the sign of the times.
Are you going to continue to have to do that, or are you holding the line at this point?
We hope not. And miraculously, when we think, you know, there's no business, what are we going to do? Some wonderful customer comes through and we get something. And we actually have somebody that just contacted us from China. They're flying in Monday. I think it was a one-day conversation. They're flying in Monday to come and look at the factory. And you know, it's that kind of thing that we think somebody's looking out for us, because I would have thought 5 years ago, if we had kept going the way we were going, we wouldn't be here. And we're still here.
Even though you sort of refuse to adjust to the
stubborn.
New, you don't, you know, we're not going to have an assembly line. We're not going to outsource, because I guess you had an offer at one point from China to actually
we thought we were going to be selling to them. And it turned out, they turned around and said, you know, we could all make a lot more money if you would bring some people here, show us how to make it, and then we would make carcass furniture. And my mom said, yeah, the carcass family would make money. This gentleman would make money, and everybody else would lose out. You know, our country,
our employees, everybody would lose out.
So. Susan, do you see these kinds of idealistic employers, or are people more focused on the bottom line? Well, I mean, when does the money just sort of force one's hand?
Well, I think a lot of it has to do, if it's a publicly held company and they're responsible to shareholders, that's one thing. But in a small family-owned company, they can much more set their own course. And, you know, going back to the example of HMC in Princeton, the person that I talked to, he really almost considered it a patriotic duty to help keep manufacturing in the U.S. because I think the anecdote he used was, if you're at war with China and China's the one that's making your ammunition, that's not going to work very well. So I think there are some companies out there that have the sort of a bigger picture in mind and that they see themselves as part of that bigger picture.
So manufacturing in this region, in the few seconds we have left, on the decline, or are we turning a corner here?
I don't know what the most recent numbers are, but I would say employment levels are not what they used to be, but it's still a very important part of the tri-state and Indiana overall.
All right. That's Susan Orr from the Courier and Press, and her article, actually somebody else's article, but an article on Cargus will be in Sunday's Courier and Press, and you can see some photographs of the factory there. Gretchen Keith, thank you so much for your time as well.
Thank you.
Just ahead, Roger McBain in to help us plan the weekend with the Arts Notebook. I'm Micah Schweitzer. The Trend continues in a minute.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Remember that you can also hear this program online. We are podcasting The Trend at WNIN.org. While you're there, check out past Tech Talk DLC programs and much more as part of our archive on WNIN.org. Stay with us. There's more of The Trend on the way.
This is The Trend on WNIN. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Time now for another weekly segment we call the Arts Notebook, and I'm joined by Roger McBain from the Courier and Press. Hi, Roger.
Good morning.
And Roger, this year Halloween is coming a little early.
Well, it is at First Presbyterian Church. Tonight at 7:30 p.m., they're screening Nosferatu, F.W. Murnau's 1922 classic vampire movie stolen from Bram Stoker's Dracula.
Before people cared about copyright infringement.
Well, they did care, actually. There was a lawsuit about it.
And the reason this is being screened at First Pres is because there's one of the finest pipe organs in the region is there.
Right. Nosferatu is a silent movie with intertitles, and it was originally intended for a theater organ. Robert Nichols, First Presbyterian's music director, thinks it would sound great on the church's massive C.B. Fisk pipe organ. It's a 20-year-old organ, but it uses some pipes that date back, 19,000 pipes in this thing. Some of them date back to the 1800s, and the mechanical action of it predates the book, which was written in the early 19th century.
So does Nosferatu come with sheet music? Do you get a reel and a stack of sheet music when you order the movie?
When the movie first came out, actually, there were some scores for it for different versions of it. But Robert Nichols is a fine improvisational player. He's been a finalist in several national competitions. And his idea was to improvise on this. He's not going to make it up on the fly tonight. He's been practicing, watching a DVD of this on a small screen so he can figure out when to cue ocean music and when to start playing when the cock crows.
Hmm. And that's, as you said, 7:30 Friday evening at First Presbyterian. It's part of a new series they're having that's going to be over the next 5 weeks or so.
Actually, yeah, it's going to be running through the end of the year. And it's going to include a lecture, performances by the American Boy Choir, another organ recital by Mr. Nichols, and another concert featuring the choir.
Okay, from silent movies to musical theater, the Civic Theater in Evansville is staging Chicago.
Chicago, that big, rude musical comedy about the public's breathless obsession with sex, scandals, murder, and fame in the roaring 20s. What they're doing, though, is setting it in a contemporary women's prison that's putting on this play from the 20s, making their own costumes and that sort of thing from what they have. Done by inmates in the women's prison with the warden and guards playing the male parts.
And one big iconic role, one of the roles in the film, or in the musical, I should say, is the lawyer Billy Flynn. And I guess there was a real last-minute casting decision made.
Literally an 11th-hour casting call at 11 p.m., 8 days before the show's opening, recruiting Bobby Lacer, an actor in Henderson, Kentucky, to play Billy Flynn, the razzle-dazzle publicity hound attorney, after somebody dropped out.
Wow. So he pulled it off, though, since it opens this Friday evening.
Tonight. It's 8 p.m., and it's also going to play Friday, tonight and Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday, and then it runs through October 30th, playing weekends.
Okay, and finally, some more theater happening over at the University of Southern Indiana, and this is Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet placed within another play, sort of like a nesting egg.
It's actually called Shakespeare's R&J, and it takes place, it's four 15-year-old boys at a parochial boys' boarding school in the 1950s trying to escape the regimentation of their daily lives. They take to the attic in the school for clandestine readings of Romeo and Juliet, reading all the parts, male and female parts, for it.
And all-male casts were the norm in Shakespeare's day, but in this play there's subtext to the all-male cast.
Right. It's a straight reading, per se, of the text, but it reveals some not-so-straight feelings between some of the boys drawn to the role of Romeo and Juliet.
So the audience is seeing a Shakespearean play, but the meaning has changed.
Well, you know, I think it's a different context. It's an expanded meaning. It's the Romeo and Juliet text set within this context, but it's still basically a story of the inextinguishable spirit of forbidden love.
And when does Shakespeare's R&J play at USI?
7:30 p.m. Today and Saturday, 2 p.m. Sunday, and then it plays again at 7:30 p.m. Tuesday through the 21st in the Millett Studio Theater at USI.
All right. Roger McBain's articles appeared in Thursday's Evansville Courier and Press, and they're also online at couriercourierpress.com. Roger joins us weekly for a look at local arts happenings, and we'll talk next week. Thanks, Roger.
Great. Thanks.
Well, we'd love to hear your reactions to this week's show, and we'll read from those comments next week. And so far, there hasn't been much work for our virtual mailman. Only you can keep him employed, so get in touch with us at WNIN.org. Next week on The Trend, the Ford Center. Evansville's new arena opens next month. Shiny exterior aside, how is it different from Roberts Stadium, and how will it affect the community? And we'll talk civil rights with Jamal Smith from the Indiana Civil Rights Commission. We'll ask about open gun carry, forced police entry, and hear about the new Power of Diversity training series. We'd love to include your questions and comments, and there are lots of ways to reach us. Just click on The Trend at WNIN.org or at couriercourierpress.com. You can stream and download a podcast of today's show at our website and couriercourierpress.com. You'll also find us on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Tony Voss is our associate producer and engineer. Our producer at the Courier and Press is Ella Johnson Watson. Our intern is Carolina Tote. The show's theme music was composed by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.